And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is news. Each of my guests is an expert in his field, and he's giving us the uncensored news. My next guest is the commander of the Seabees at Naval Base Station of Ventura County. We'll discuss leadership, the Seabees, and the recent deployments with the 31st CB Readiness Group Commander and the NFLEC Commanding Officer. If you want to ask questions of Captain John Corca, or if you just want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Captain John Corca was born in Rota, Spain. He received his Bachelor's of Science degree in Civil Engineering from Old Dominion University back in 1986, and he was commissioned as an ensign through the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps program. That's ROTC for those of you who like acronyms. After completing his first CB tour, he attended Penn State University and received his Master's of Science in Civil Engineering. Captain Corca's personal decorations are many, but they include a Bronze Star and Meritorious Service Medals four times over. He's a graduate of the National Defense University Industrial College of the Armed Forces and the Executive Training Program at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. He's a registered professional engineer and a member of the Defense Acquisition Community and is a designated CB Combat Warfare Officer. That is an incredible set of credentials. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Great, and glad to have you here as well. Now, I noticed that right off the bat, you were born in Rota, Spain. So my first question to you is, do you come from a military family? Because Rota made me think of our naval bases over in Spain.
Yes, actually, my father proudly served our country for 24 years. And he was stationed there taking some Spanish classes. And he happened to meet this lady who introduced him to her sister, which ended up being my mother. So I was born there. I still have family there. It's sort of, as I look back, I'm sort of blessed that I have that cultural awareness of Spain and the Mediterranean lifestyle. So it's benefited me very well. And having a dad as a prior service member has actually strengthened me as an officer in the United States military.
And John, which service did he serve in?
He actually was in the Navy.
He was in the Navy, just as you are as well. And the story just goes to show the advantages of continuing education. You just never know where it's going to lead you.
You never know. That is absolutely correct.
All right. Well, give us a brief history of the Seabees, because I know very little about it, and here we are. We're in a military town, and I profess ignorance to that.
I will start off to say, when you think of the United States Navy, you sort of think of ships. Okay, and actually, when I came into the Navy, I actually served on ships. Mm-hmm. You know, you either float, you're underwater, surveilling the ocean floors, or you fly in the skies. The Seabees is actually came into existence during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
During World War II, there was a need to actually have advanced bases in the Pacific. We needed to construct bases as the Marines occupied islands out there. So they were actually established as a construction organization to support the war efforts during World War II. And that was, they were actually commissioned on March 5th, 1942. And over 250,000 CB served during World War II, which was a pretty remarkable feat. And they just basically built forward runways, installations, fuel depots across the Pacific. And they also contributed to the European campaign as well.
Now, how did they contribute in Europe? That's interesting, because you don't think of Europe as a sea war.
You don't, but there's pontoons. Okay, so you have to sort of get people ashore.
That's
okay,
right.
So the engineering efforts were able to get people ashore. So that's actually, once the Seabees were commissioned and recognized, that's how Port Hueneme came into existence. So Port Hueneme was our depot here back in 1942. And after the war, it became a base. And so this was our launching platform for the Pacific Fleet for the Seabees. On the East Coast, it was Davisville, Rhode Island. And right now, Davisville is no longer in existence. It's still there, but we don't have a military installations there.
Hmm.
And it's actually now in Gulfport, Mississippi.
I see.
So this is actually the home, Ventura County, Naval Base Ventura County. It is the home of the Pacific Fleet Seabees.
Yet another first for Ventura County. My guest is Captain John Corca. John, how many men do you have currently serving underneath you?
In my capacity as the commander of the 31st CB Readiness Group, there's approximately just a little over 2,000 CBs
wow.
that are associated.
That's an impressive command.
It is, but there's a lot of units. You know, our organization is responsible for training the battalions, and we have four battalions, naval construction battalions here. We also have an underwater construction team here, and then we have another unit in San Diego that's sort of spread across the western coast. So the four battalions here is what I call the meat and potatoes.
Mm.
I've had the distinct honor and pleasure of welcoming. I've been here since June of last year, and I have had the honor to welcome each one of those battalions back from serving in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, shall we? Because, you know, what is the role of the CBs right now in modern warfare? Again, when you think of Afghanistan, a landlocked country, you don't think water. So what's the role over there? What's the role in Iraq, which is a desert country? Again, you don't think of water.
Well, I will tell you the mission is obvious, is pretty apparent, is to prosecute, Taliban forces, terrorists out there. And so you sort of need a platform to launch from. So the CBs basically build forward operating bases out there. They built runways, they built roads and bridges to allow for freedom of movement. If you recall, just not too long ago when they had the presidential surge, they said, hey, we're going to increase the forces. Well, you know, the forces that you need before you can start fighting is you sort of need a resting place, if you will. You know, where are you going to store your ammunition? How is the equipment going to, where is it going to be staged? Where's the berthing, the facilities that you need for command and control? So the engineers are part of that early development for the surge. So our CBs were called upon there to sort of build some roads and some launching platforms.
Well, that brings up an interesting point then, John, because if the CBs are on the leading edge of that in harm's way, are they truly the advanced group that's in more harm's way than perhaps the rest of the troops coming along that will occupy the base the CBs build?
Well, I think everyone's in harm's way.
Okay, fair enough.
I will tell you that. You know, we have had our share of heroes, if you will. We have had our fair of Purple Hearts awarded to some of our CBs. So I will tell you that they are, in certain areas, in certain missions, they are exposed to enemy fire. But again, it's in support of the operating forces that are there.
Mm.
I sort of have a picture here just to show you of a runway that was built. And as you can see, you can tell your customer, it's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
you know, and
for those of you on the radio, of course, you can't see this, but we've got, it looks like a C-135 taking off from a runway that is literally, as far as the eye can see, it is desolate. There's nothing but sand there, and then, of course, there's this runway.
Right, so that, of course, is bringing supplies in, and if you flip to the other page, that's a F-14 landing there. And for an F-14, you know, you need a certain length of a runway. Well, that's a resting gear that was built so they can sort of trap the aircraft to land.
So you actually build a runway that was more similar to the deck of an aircraft carrier than it was to an Air Force runway that might be 5 miles long or however long you need for a Tomcat to land.
That's correct. You know, the CB motto, can do.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The difficult takes, I guess, the difficult takes a little bit longer, but the difficult we can do at once, the impossible takes a little bit longer. So, again, I sort of say that's CB ingenuity. And again, this was built by Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 5, who's actually here in Port Hueneme.
A big shout out to them. Congratulations,
so,
guys.
You know, another bridge laying mission.
Right.
You know, there's a, you know, there's a canal. You need to cross it. So how do you get over it? So again, it's pretty impressive. I have pictures here working at night. Temperature. There's a forward operating base there, middle of nowhere.
Right.
Okay, that houses 30,000 people.
30,000 people in the middle of nowhere. It comes up and literally is built overnight. The question then, John, I have for you is what happens when we leave? I mean, we leave these structures behind, of course. Do we turn them over to civilians? Do we sell them to civilians? What happens?
Well, as part of the exit strategy, of course, we don't sell them. They're all temporary in nature.
Okay.
I mean, we don't build permanent structures. They're all, you can see light frame construction, block work. So it is temporary contingency type construction. So the exit strategy would sort of dictate what remains in place, what comes back. So
Let's talk, if we can. My guest is Captain John Korka of the CBs here at Naval Station Ventura County. John, what happens? The president just announced we're going to pull back 20,000 troops out of Afghanistan. We've got these temporary structures that the CBs have built, and to me they look permanent, but I guess they are considered temporary by you all. given time. I suppose the desert would take them back. But, you know, what does happen when the president calls back 20,000 troops? What does that mean logistically? Because we can all think about moving the equipment into Afghanistan or moving the equipment into Iraq, but we don't ever think about taking it back out.
Well, I will tell you that there's a lot of planning going on right now and trying to develop different courses of actions. And each course of action will probably have some advantages, disadvantages, pros and cons. And so then it's based over a timeline. And so now you sort of just play a lot of what-if scenarios. What are the objectives? And what are the critical factors that we need to consider? So, again, I think it's just a lot of smart people getting around a table and having some discussions. But, again, this is done, you know, over an extended period of time and across many different services. So it's not just the Navy. There's the Army, the Marines, the Air Force. Everyone has a say on, hey, how are they contributing to the overall mission? And what needs to be drawn down? There's a lot of different forces. There's civil affairs. There's combat units. There's a lot of forces there. So there'll be a priority placed on what does that number represent.
I see.
You know, so it's don't know until we know. So we will see that.
All right. Well, now you are an expert, John, in logistics. I mean, that's what all of your academic training is for. And, of course, your whole military career has been built around that. So give us an idea, if you will, for those of us that are civilians, what are the logistics behind putting troops into a battle and taking troops out of the battle? What sorts of things do we have to move in there that maybe we don't think about? And toilet paper comes to mind for me, but I'm sure that there's more than that.
It is. We actually are an expeditionary unit, okay? So we have a lot of plans on the shelf. So we know different types of environments that we have to deploy to. We may not know the exact location, but we know what sort of environment we need to deploy to. We also know what our capabilities are. Our capabilities of what we do is sort of set in doctrine. So as you start your planning process, you sort of say, well, what do I need to satisfy this mission that I'm supposed to do? And then what sort of type of things do I need based on the environment? Obviously, if I go to a cold environment, I need certain items as opposed to a warm climate. So we sort of lay that. So we sort of have a listing of all the things that we need. And we procure them over time, and we store them. So I can talk in particular for a CB unit, and all expeditionary units, they have these tables of allowances. And tables of allowances, in simple terms, it's you have equipment's part of that table of allowance. You have communications gear, which is command and control. You have weapons, and then you have materials and supplies. Okay, so when you add all that together, that's my table of allowance.
Okay.
And I'm talking, if you look at these containers, I will tell you just for a mobile construction battalion, which is roughly 600 personnel, we have just a little over 200 pieces of equipment.
Wow.
Okay, you know, I'm talking dozers, you know, Humvees, transportation type vehicles, line haul equipment, and any type of construction, you know, water wells is another popular item that we use a lot. And then we have communications equipment, okay, and all sorts of satellite communications, high frequency, ultra high frequencies, very high frequencies. And then, of course, our weapons. You know, we have a complement of weapons that we use.
Sure.
From a defensive posture. We're not an offensive unit, okay.
But we do need to protect ourselves.
And then, of course, we have a lot of materials, okay, toolkits, okay, the toilet paper, the printer paper. And those are all staged. We have them staged here, you know, in Port Hueneme. The containers is about 160 containers, 20 by 8 by 8. So that, you know, just imagine those containers. Now, so if you go to a mission, what do you need to put together to meet that mission? So they're all based on capability sets. So it depends on what the mission is and what we transport over. And so we have the stuff, and then we coordinate the movement. And the movement is based on priority, and the movement is based on what it will fit on. Some of it will go by air. Okay, the more important stuff that we have to get there quicker goes by air, and some of it will go by sea. So it's all time phased, okay? And that this again, I sort of, you know, hats off to the military. You know, this the Seabreeze are just one of many pieces, but that is the level of detail. And during our home port period, when we're here, we plan, we train, and we rehearse. We plan, train, and rehearse so we can meet the objectives if we're ever called upon.
Oh. Now, John, what is the fastest that you've ever been called in to do? I mean, the thought of 600 men, that 160-odd containers going someplace, what's the fastest you've ever been able to get men in and started?
We're trained to get out in 48 hours.
48 hours. That is incredible.
Okay, and that's just not all 600, but with an advance party.
Wow.
Okay. So, and again, but we're staged around the globe. You know, we have launching platforms, not just here in Port Hueneme, but we have four deployed sites that, you know, a lot of our stuff is staged. We have ships that are floating right now in the Indian Ocean, in the Pacific, that stays, has some of our equipment and our tables of allowance, if you will.
Wow, that is great. My guest is Captain John Korka of the Seabees here at Naval Station Ventura County. So, you know, this is a bad economic time for a lot of us that are out there. Talk to me about the Seabees as a career. I mean, you are obviously a career man yourself on this, but why would somebody, particularly now, think about getting into the Seabees? Obviously, there's great training, but tell me more. What are some of the advantages?
I will tell you that not just the Seabees, but in the military service. Okay, some people may say we have a responsibility to serve our country. Okay, some people may not know what they want to do, and they may think of joining the military. The military in general has a lot of different skill sets. You know, the Seabees is a construction skill set.
Right.
You can be a builder, you can be an electrician, you can be a mechanic, an equipment operator. But there's other areas, too, across the Navy. You can be a sonar technician. You can be an IT specialist down dealing with computers. So a supply specialist. So financial specialist. So we have a lot of different trades and vocations within the military. And I think that, you know, you have your honor and your calling to serve, and then you also learn something. I think you learn. You know, a lot of times people may not know once they come out of high school what they want, and the military will shape you into being a better person, a skilled individual, and a person with a high sense of honor and responsibility. So, and if you like to stay and enjoy it, then you continue. But if not, I think you're well equipped to operate in the private sector.
Well, it certainly gives you the skill sets that you need and the equipment training and everything else. So, John, let's just play this out a little bit farther if we can. Suppose I'm just graduating high school right now, and it is high school graduation season.
It
I'm
is.
Hearing the sound
it
of
is.
Our voice.
It
and
is.
I don't know what I want to do, but I have an idea that I want to run a backhoe. I want to be a heavy machinery operator at some point. So talk to me, the men and the women in your command, what are they like, and what sorts of people will I be interacting with if I were to join the Seabees in order to get my backhoe training or my heavy equipment training?
I will tell you that the young men and women serving today, I'm impressed. We have got a lot of talented, smart, young people coming into our service. I look at their test scores, and I'm in awe. Their motivation. They're compassionate, their willingness to serve, and just their attitude. You know, these are hard times in the military. You know, the operate, at least in the Seabees in particular, the op tempo is very high. But it's sort of, you grab all these different groups of people from different parts of the world and different, you know, different states, East Coast, West Coast, but yet they come together with a common goal or a common objective, and that's their love of their country. I really do believe that. And then you see them mixed together, and they learn a lot from one another. They build friendships that they would have probably never built before. They learn and go to places that they probably never heard of. And so, you know, it's pretty impressive. And where does it start? It starts at the high school with your counselor, okay, steering them in the right direction and talking to people to give them an idea what they're getting into. So the local recruiters, I think you actually have one off of...
We do, a telephone and Maine.
Okay, there is a recruiter there. So talk to people. You can come to the base, you know, and get a tour at any time. And so I guess it's just talking to people, understanding what you want. And there's a lot of people, I will tell you firsthand, that the only reason I came into the military was because they paid my way through school. Okay,
You come from a military family. I mean, you have that honor, you have that discipline.
I thought that it was... a responsibility that I had.
Right.
Okay, so I didn't plan to stay, but I enjoyed what I was doing. The Navy, I thought, took care of me. You know, the thing is, I really see the military caring for people. We actually care about people's lives. We're responsible for people's lives. And in the private sector, I'm not saying they don't, but you know, if someone gets in trouble, we take that pretty seriously. Okay, we discipline accordingly. And we promote accordingly. So it is part of being involved in someone's life. Some people may or may not like that, though.
Well, without a doubt. And I see your face light up when you start talking about the men and the women in your command. That is great. And that's a sign of true leadership. Just in the short time that we've got remaining, John, talk to me about leadership. What does the CBs train you, the men and women that work with you, about leadership that will serve them well when they go back into civilian life?
I will tell you that one of the things that I look for a leader is that you're really dependent on two things. You depend on people and you rely on trust. Okay, you know, our success comes from our people's success. And as you get promoted at different levels, we have a continuum of leadership development and training. So as people start getting promoted, their level of responsibility increases, and we actually either send them through training in the classroom, or we provide conferences and forums to teach them about the next level of responsibility and what they're taking on. So I think that the military does a very good continuum of training, you know, that's at the enlisted level as well as the officer level. We actually have, you know, senior enlisted academies that our folks eventually try to go to. You know, you sort of read my resume. I only came into the Navy with an undergraduate degree. You know, that's it. You know, they send me to get a technical degree at a master's. I went to the War College to understand strategy. When I went to Dartmouth, that was sort of executive strategic level thinking that I was sitting in with different people from Mitsubishi, Chevron. So, and I also had military courses that every time I went through a rank, there was an indoctrination about what does it mean to that next level, and what are people expecting of you as a leader, and what should you expect of your troops in your new position.
That is great. My guest is Captain John Korka. He's the 31st CB Readiness Group Commander and the NFLEC Commanding Officer. John, thank you so much for being my guest.
Well,
if people want to learn more about the CBs, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
There is a website, www.cb.mil. www.cb.navy.mil. Okay? And we also have social media, www.facebook.com/CB Magazine, okay, and you can learn about that. I do want to put a plug in, of course, for CB Days for the locals here. We used to do them every year. Now it's once a year, we used to do them once a year. Now they're every 2 years, and that is going to be on the 23rd and 24th of July. Our guests of honor and guest speaker is the Chief of Civil Engineer and the King Bee. I also know that the CB Museum will be open that weekend. It's not 100%, but it's sort of a soft opening. But this is an opportunity for people to sort of thank the men and women who have sort of protected that cherished freedom that we enjoy. There'll be a beautiful parade. You know, CBs can do, but they can also march as well. So this is just an opportunity for you to probably come on board and shake the hand of a service member to say thank you. And also, thank their families, because families go through a lot.
And that is CB Days coming up in July. We'll be talking more about that as we get closer to CB Days. Captain John Korka, thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Hoorah, Billy. Thank you very much.